It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Good afternoon, listeners throughout the interior. Welcome back to our program known as Alaska Tracks, where we listen to interviews I recorded with veteran trappers and guides and biologists and hunters. My name is Randy Zarnke, and I'm the host of the program. Today's guest is Richard Carroll from Fort Yukon. The Carroll name has a long history in the Fort Yukon area. Richard's father came into the country over 100 years ago. The family lived off the land for generations. Richard is a very good storyteller, although he proclaims that he doesn't tell stories. Let's listen to his explanation of that seeming paradox.
Thank you. I got a call here a couple weeks ago from a gentleman I never met before, and they want to know if I'd come down and be a guest speaker. I was so flabbergasted, I don't know whether I said yes or no, but I'm here. And I want to thank you. I can't tell stories. I'm a BSer. I can tell you some pure facts, and that'd be the way it is. Let me go back and tell you part of our family history. My dad came up in 1910. Says they had a very poor family. They had to sell everything, and he finally got his passage and came up. But he came up by Circle, and he spent his first winter in the Circle area working for old man Miller. He said at that time he was a pretty young man. I think he's 17 years old. Miller, some of the other old men in the area, and kind of took him under his wings, and he stayed there that winter. And he finally met a guy named Blackjack. He was an elderly man who was supposed to be a good trapper and know the whole area, and so he talked my dad into being his partner. He's going to make him rich, forget the gold. So they got in a little squares boat, as we call them, and floated down the Circle of Fort Yukon, and he got himself an outfit from trader there, and they went up the Salmon River, which today is called the Sheenjik. The cabin they built still stands today. Blackjack's cabin, we call 7 miles up the mouth of Sheenjik. Blackjack, of course, didn't know anything about trapping, and neither did my dad. I think they both got in an argument over certain tracks in the snow and didn't materialize what it was supposed to be. From there on to 1927, during this period, my dad met my mother, and they got married. They would go out in the trap line. In those days, it was much different than it is today. It wasn't the snow machine or the airplane. They packed the kids along in two toboggans. And like everybody else in those days, you'd go right on the trap line and trap. The woman trapped and helped the man just as much. I had lost two brothers in those days. One froze to death in the tent up to Porcupine. And the second one caught a flu or something, I was told, and died out in the woods. Life continued. It was time of life in those days. These things happen. Traditionally, we still follow the same thing today. There are other families, many families, that trapped in that area. You probably read Evelyn Shore's book. We know the family very well. We're very close to the Roberts. And they trapped up what we call the Salmon River today, but it's really a part of the Black River. In about 1935, a lot of the names have changed. Well, that gives you a little history. I came along about that time when my dad moved back into Fort Yukon and started a trading post. He was such a good friend of the natives and knew how to trap, and all the natives and some white people, believe me, had to do was give him a good bullshit story, and he gave him a big outfit. Well, it was 2 years later that my dad had to go to the other store downtown and give them a line so he can get an outfit to go out trap again and start over. It was quite a vicious circle, believe me. During 1930 to 1942, my dad made enough money trapping to go back in business again. Of course, it was the beginning of the war, and things were different, but and he bought fur. He flew around quite a bit. He used to buy fur for a Goldstein company. Him and a little Jewish fur buyer named John Swigler used to travel together. They bought for the same company, and they bid against the trappers and the furs. It was interesting how this worked. I don't think you find many fur buyers today would be partners and bid against one another, but it was the name of the game in those days. It was interesting to see my dad start off from Fort Yukon. He'd had three dogs, and I remember his wheel dog was called Rum. He must have been at least 3 feet high and about 5 feet long and 2 feet wide. And my brother, older brother, Tommy, used to go with him, and they'd take off from Fort Yukon on a toboggan about 5 feet long and, you know, regular 16-inch wide toboggan. We didn't use sleds up in that area. A lot of people in the Tana area use. We used toboggans because the snow was soft. My brother would always tell the story, especially if you get a cup of can of beer in him. He tell how this damn heavy debug, he never saw the front of it because he's always behind trying to hold it up. He didn't know which way it was flopping. And they'd stay out in the woods for 2 months and come back later on, probably after New Year's. This is how he got started back in business again. It's interesting today as we trap, we say, how'd you go out in the woods today? I drove 16 miles up the highway and took my snowblower off and ran up in the woods and set a few traps. Well, this is nice, but it isn't trapping. It isn't really getting out there, what we call siwashing out. You don't take no tent and you actually build a spruce bough house and keep warm night after night until you get your lines out and come back in. Our style is a little different than what we call a local style. Fort Yukon has 24-hour trappers. They go out on a weekend and set a few traps, and you don't see them again next week. Whatever they got caught, got torn out or something. It's all trapping, but it isn't like the old-time trapping, where the families go out in the fall, load up their boats. I have pictures that I'd like to have brought. I didn't have time to bring them. Our boats loading up in Fort Yukon, especially inboards, their old launches, as we call them. Families, 30 dogs just go out, and we don't see them again until, if they run short of groceries or food, got a bad meat year, they would come in probably after New Year's. But the main family does not come in until the following May. And they all come in and bring their furs in, and the fur buyers would know what time they're coming in, and they'd all have one hell of a party. They all try to get the fur buyer drunk in those days. Heck, it is, it always backfired. the fur buyers finally caught on. They generally come up with the best deal, believe me.
When your dad and your brother would go out on that toboggan, how long of a line would they be running? Would it be 50 miles or 100 miles?
Oh, well, they take from Fort Yukon up to Bear Nose Mountain, which probably is 200 mile one way. I got married pretty young. I think I was 17. My wife and I said we're going to go out trapping. We had a guy take us upriver to our camp with a boat. Pushed off and left us on the snowy beach, and here we were, a couple of crazy kids. We had 7 good dogs and got our stuff up to the cabin. And the first thing we're going to do is get a moose. But my dad taught me, you got to get your winter meat in. We went moose hunting the next day. And we weren't gone more than 30 minutes from the cabin, and damn, we didn't hear Bull racking his horn. We're in luck. We sneaked around, and damn, if we went over further this way, we'd hear that noise behind us. We went around the moose, or the moose went around us. We didn't know which. Well, after about 4 hours of going around the circle and we still haven't located this moose, we really didn't know what it was. We said, well, we better sit down and find out where we are at. We're lost. We're staggering out here in the woods and following this moose, and the moose is going around in circles. As we were resting, we damned, I didn't hear that antler rubbing up above. Well, you know, the wind come along, how these tall, dry trees once in a while we hit. And there was our moose. Tired, disgusted, got skunked the first day, but we were lost. We were physically lost from our cabin. So after it started to get a little dark, I did have the sense we better climb a tree. So I went up a tree, and you know, we weren't more than a quarter mile from our cabin. It was right in front of us. So we went home, and that ended my moose hunting trip for the year. We had a lot of crazy experience. Now, if you've ever taken your wife out in a trap line, thought you're going to really make a go of it, come time to do some bacon, she doesn't know a thing about how you're going to bake on top of a heater. We'd like to have cake once in a while or biscuits, and how do we go about doing it? Oh, we had a lot of fun. I think the best experience I had, I was walking along back in the trailer. We had about 6 inches of snow on the ground. Don't ask me if the season was open or not, because those days we didn't worry about seasons. And I went back walking, and damn if I didn't see some tracks. And I figured out it was a link track. I set a bunch of snares. And a couple days later, we went back, looked. Well, I didn't know that you don't get a link the first night. It takes about 7 days, and it took me about 7 years later to find this out. I did catch a link. It was a beautiful animal. And the first thing, of course, you do, you're so proud, you put the damn link around your neck. And I came home with this link. I told my wife, Eva, I says, look what I caught. I got this beautiful link. Here it is. I hung it up in the house. I'm going to skin it after supper. Well, we skinned it, all right. You know, about 2 o'clock that morning, I come straight out of that bed, and I couldn't figure what the hell was wrong. Somebody was cutting my back. I told her, look at my back and see what it is. Something terrible wrong. She says, you know, you got lice. I said, where in the hell do I get lice from? I says, watch it, make sure. Yeah, she says, I see all these red things. They're all over you, all down your shirt and everywhere. Well, we were stumped. We really didn't know where this lice came from. In fact, we didn't know until about 2 weeks later, our neighbor come up and visit us, and I was telling him about the lice that we were getting. You'd be careful in here with us. He laughed. He said, there were fleas from the link. He says, they're the worst louse carrier there is. Well, the only way to relieve that night, we tried two or three things, and we had a bottle of iodine solution and swabbed my back with it, and it relieved the itch immediately. At least I learned something. We always take a bottle of iodine along in case you get bugs on you after this. It really worked. We just got married, like I said. We were sort of on our honeymoon on a big trapping deal. Our friends gave us gifts, a lot of dishes. We had glass pots and four-piece glassware, and we had a glass percolator and wash tub. So as we moved, we took everything with us. Threw all the glass dishes in the toboggan, not knowing what's going on. It's strange that every night when we camped, we had less and less dishes. It never dawned on us. Talk about no brains and young crazy kids. But we had quite an experience that first year. We were going to go riding that spring, and we went to a lake. Now listen, the 40s. We heard that night a damn sound. It sounded like a bear growling and just tearing timber apart. Didn't know what it was. My dad gave me a 30-40 Craig that I used. The sound kept coming closer and closer to the tent. And we didn't have dogs with the camp. I had to get up, open the tent, something right out the door. Every time I get up and look around, the sound disappeared. So I knew damn well there was something out there, because the minute we laid back down, it would start again. Well, I'm going to fix it. I get up, aim my rifle in the woods, and I emptied the gun 5 times in the woods this way, and load it up and empty the other side. Whatever's out there would be scared away. Well, the noise came again, and it came just as close as it was before. I think I had 20-some shells with me, and I shot them all off. Thought I'd scare the animal away, which didn't help. The same friend that came up telling me about the fleas had to come by. And he says, Tim, I was very far from us. I heard you shooting last night. Where'd you get? No, I said, there's some animal around here. Making all kind of sound, tearing up trees. Yeah, I don't see no tracks. Well, I says, they were here. What it was, the warm night, light wind, and the trees were popping, they were thawing. And as the trees would pop, I thought it was a grizzly out there, you know, just coming closer and closer. Well, we got out of there, in a way, the next day. There's some of these little incidents that you remember. I've been married 50 years. I have 12 children. I have 22 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren. One of the things I've learned later on in life, I observed tonight in here that there were some children. You may not know it when you're young, but the greatest thing that you can give and pass on, I think, is some of the experiences that you have, and the greatest way to pass that experience on is to take your children or a friend's children with you and take them out, give them the true experience of what it is like out here in the woods. I have a friend in Fairbanks, I won't mention his name, and he has a son about the age of mine. At the time, they were about 13 years old. And I said, why don't you let me take your son out in the woods all summer and he can camp out with us. It'd be a very good experience for him. And I said, we have a spare rifle that he can use. That's all I had to say. The mother says, a rifle, a gun, my son, nothing doing. So you do have those people. It's too bad. You don't have to be a trapper to take your son out or some members of your family, your grandchildren. It's nice to just be out there. Can't make it in the wintertime, go in the summer. Well, another crazy experience I've had the same year before we moved out of the country. Another young fella who were trapping muskrats. We were back in the lake. We heard somebody yelling, like a woman's voice shrieking. Somebody's calling us. Clear down the other end of the lake, we saw this object coming out, and here it was my wife, yelling my name. And we went down to meet her. She was all excited and out of breath. I says, "What's wrong?" "There's a monster coming across the river, coming right to the cabin. Our cabin's right on the Porcupine." I says, "Is it a bear?" "It's a big one if it is, coming straight to the house." Well, we went by slow and put her in the toboggan and Isaac and handlebars, and I walked ahead as we got close to the cabin. Put her all in the chamber, and I looked. First, I was looking for the track of this monster that's supposed to be coming. Nothing. I says, "Did you close the door when you left, or did you leave it open?" She says, "The door is open. I just ran out." Slowly opened the door, shoved the gun in there, and here was our neighbor upriver, Philip Peter. I'm about 4 miles from us, from north of Sheemjik. He walked down and left his snowshoe over there and cut across. And he ran into some snow drifts and was waddling along. And those days, a lot of people wore the homemade parkas. And he opened his parka, it got too hot. And as he was coming across there, and his park opened, my wife had in mind this big monster was coming across the river. Philip looked at us and he says, "What's the matter? I come here, door open, food on the table, I eat, I sleep, now you come at me with a gun." I said, "Forget it, Philip. It's a long story. Glad to see you."
Wonderful stories from a time long gone. Let's take a commercial break and then come back for more stories from Richard. Thanks to our sponsors for their continued support of this program. Now let's hear more great stories from Richard Carroll of Fort Yukon.
We moved on our way into Fort Yukon. Young Isaac went in with us. He always make fire up in the woods. Kind of nice spot, sort of clear snow way, and we cooked lunch. And our dogs became very alert of something wrong. Tell your dogs are tired. All of a sudden, their ears are up and they're smelling this something. I thought I heard something, but I wasn't sure. Now we had our lunch. And we went on down to 17 miles and on down to Fort Yukon. And 17 miles, old Jim Freaks come along and he says, "What the hell you guys were doing up there? Trying to dig that bear out of the hole?" I said, "What bear?" "Well, you built a fire right over it. What are you doing?" I know it's hard to believe. There may be 100,000 acres out there. But how we happened to spare the place and build our lunch fire over a bear den, I do not know the extent. But that's what happened. And the bear came out, believe it or not, two of them. And they eventually got killed down below Fort Yukon. Well, it takes years of getting the experience in trapping. I know each one of us think we had a little secret of our own. We don't like to show it to somebody else. We keep our baits and lures hidden. Well, I've got a secret too. My secret is of all things to use muktuk. And I find muktuk the best marten bait there is. Muktuk and beaver caster. It never freezes. So you've got to smell, whether it's 50 below or otherwise, you still got that smell in there. I'm in marten country where I trap. Martin, wolves, wolverine. We get the link too, but unless the link price is good. But Martin's our main source. Early in the fall, if you went along in my Martin line, you'd think a couple of women had been around. Because early in the fall, the best Martin lure there is perfume. The most horrible smelling perfume you can find. And generally, in a catalog, you'll find these seven little bottles for about $2, you know? And that's what I do is order a bunch for the kids. I got eight girls, and they each get their bottle of perfume. And about a week later, I ask for it. "Do you want it?" "No, I take it." "Well, I got my baits." "Yeah, you didn't care." Remember that in warm country, the only lure you use is something that's intense, and that a Martin will, actually, as they walk along, if you watch Martin come, they'll come along and out here, and if you've got a perfume or a high scent like anise or even beaver caster, if you want to waste it that time of year, they'll make a 90-degree turn and go right to your scent. Every time. Very interesting. So many people tried next fall. Try a perfume. Get the cheapest perfume and the stinkest one. If you take dogs on the trap line and you run into a marten line, my suggestion is, and I learned the hard way, turn the team around and go back. Go back 3 or 4 miles and set up your camp and then walk, because one dog will scare a whole damn hillside of Martin Way. Mm-hmm. Just take one. All he has to do is sit out there and howl. We've came upon a place where Martin dens were all over and there was just tracks. And I was with a friend of mine and he had a dog, a McKenzie Husky. As long as the dog was moving in the harness, he shut up. But the minute he got tied up, he started howling. And we didn't realize it at the time. We set a whole bunch of traps that night, expect to get a Martin in every trap. We never got one. For 3 days, we never got anything. It finally dawned on us, there's something wrong. Either we're doing something wrong or something's wrong with our system. And an old timer came by and told us that your dog's barking, you're too close to Martin. And they'll actually go 7, 8 miles away and resettle again. We've always learned that, and any old timer today will tell you that chapter dogs, they make their tent somewhere, then they walk 4 or 5 miles and set their sidelines. Never tie your dogs and says, I'm going to set traps here. It's nice and easy. You think you're going to make it, but you don't. That was something that we learned the hard way. After catching on to how the fur buyers buy fur, maybe some of you guys know little tricks too. I sort my own and grade and select my own Martin, see, and I pick out those nice big ones and I put them aside. Fur buyer comes along and got the fur, yeah, I got a lot of Martin. Gives you a good price, and you think to yourself, damn it, if he's giving me that good price, what is he going to give me for those others I got hid? Of course, you know what they say, I knew you had some others. The fur buyer that used to buy a lot of fur in the country, you all know him very well, is Ron Long. Ron would pick out a porcupine marten from a pile of marten. He knew that the Porcupine River, the upper Porcupine, had special feed. We can never figure out what it is yet, but the marten are big and black. It ain't like coming down to the Yukon and your marten is yellow and lousy and short and small and kinky colors and stuff. It's the feed. I'm very sure it's the feed. I think you're in a blueberry country. Someone's mentioning about voles tonight. Sometime we can walk around and hear them squeak in the wintertime underneath us in the moss. We're in good marten country. And the only trouble is we get burned out once in a while. Fires are great on the Colleen River. Not so bad in the Porcupine, but on the Colleen they are. I imagine many of you look through Cabell's catalog and you order a lot of stuff like I do in it, or some of the other outdoor sports catalog. But my dad taught me years ago that the warmest and the best sleeping material you can get is a good tanned caribou hide. He had a caribou hide outer shell sleeping bag, and all he had inside was a very thin sleeping bag, and he can sleep out in snowbank at 50 below. The warmest thing there is caribou skin. So if you can't get caribou skin, the next time you're on a hunt, buy a reindeer skin, which this is good, a little heavier. But a caribou skin will save your life out there in the woods. The only one thing, remember, keep it dry. Don't let it get rain on in the summertime. You want to go another step further for good footing, have someone make caribou skin booties for you, hair inside. Today you see bush pilots flying around, and you either got a pair of shoe packs on or one of them bunny boots. 25, 30 years ago, you never saw that. Well, those bush pilots, they had canvas boots, which we use, or they got caribou skin legging boots. That's the warmest, they knew. And I was telling Dean today, I'm sure that the game wardens know it, if they have any common sense, that when you go out in the woods, that you will violate the law some way out there. You can't help it. You're going to catch a camp robber in a trap, and that's against the law. It's not your intention of doing this. But you make it damn hungry comes January, and if you're stuck for meat, you're going to have to get a moose. No ifs, ands, or buts. You're going to have to survive. It ain't like going down to the NC store or to the Safeway and try to stock up. You have these things. And I think that they pretty much know this. If they've been out in the line themselves, they know that this is true. 27 years. I've never had a state game warden come to see me on official business. I had one land one time, and the only reason he landed, he had to relieve himself and get back in the airplane and get off. Fish and wildlife people visit. I think they see violations. But if you're out there and you're really making a living off the country and it's your land, I don't think they'll bother you. I really don't. But I think if you shoot a cow moose and put some traps by it, yes, you're asking for trouble. Normally, I've never seen a game warden, and I know that they're around, but they never come in. Never had problems with game wardens. I did a lot of foolish things. I had an operation when I was a teenager. I became a vegetarian for several years. So I was going trapping. I'd eat my lunch in my toboggan. I'd straddle myself over the toboggan. I had a can of kerosene with some kerosene rags in it, and I'd light it, warm my can of peas up on it, and I'd eat going across the lake. One day that the fellow got a cab meal and the lake happened to be home. He couldn't figure it out. What the hell is coming across this lake? He thought it was a locomotive or something, you know? The puff of smoke was coming up and I was going along. As I drew up closer to him, Pete was a very foul-mouthed individual. And after 5 minutes of cursing me, he says, "What are you doing? Why you got a fire in the toboggan?" I said, "Well, I keep my hands warm and I'm eating my lunch. I'm eating a can of peas, which was my diet that time. It's the only thing I could eat." He went to town and told the story. Hey, he told my dad, "I think your son is cracking up." He builds a damn fire in his toboggan and going along the woods eating. He won't stop and make a fire like anybody else, you know. These are some of the stories that they have on me up there.
It's hard for me to put into words just how much I enjoy listening to guys like Richard Carroll talk about life back in the good old days. Tune in again next week when we'll hear from another veteran outdoorsman on Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.